Hi, and welcome to the RUP podcast. I'm James Roycroft Davis, and I founded this podcast after I recently found myself in a rut, feeling like I was never going to come out. But I did, because I started talking about how I felt. This podcast features mostly men's stories about getting into a rut, what it was like being there, but most importantly, how they got out of it.
In this episode of The Rut, I sit down with professional rugby player Jono Kitto, who opens up about his incredible story battling severe depression and anxiety in his teenage years back in New Zealand. Jono has played for some of the biggest names in English rugby, in Leicester Tigers, Harlequins and now Worcester Warriors, as well as being capped internationally by New Zealand under-20s. Jono developed a perfectionist complex in his teenage years, through his relationship with his dad, and this complex led him to want to take his own life because it became so debilitating. Thankfully, he didn't, and after finally talking about his issues, he addressed the underlying complex and now understands fully the series of events which led to his demise in his mental health. Jono talked me through the range of emotions he encountered when he was in his rut, how a mirror helped him to get out of his rut, how one woman's kindness at a Leicester Tigers game showed in the impact that talking can have on someone. Here's Jono's story. So as always, please leave all judgment at the door. Jono, how are you, buddy?
I'm good, mate. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. I love this part where I pretend that we haven't spoken before and it's the first time we're recording.
Yeah, it's
good. Good to see you, mate. How are you? How's things?
Yeah, all good. Yeah, it's obviously a bit of a strange time, but yeah, we've sort of, my wife and I have managed to sort of get a routine in this time and try and make the most of it. So we've found a bit of enjoyment in it. And yeah, otherwise we're probably like the rest of the population sort of waiting for things to get back to normal in some sense. For me, that means a bit of rugby and a bit of sport. So I've got that sooner rather than later. Yeah.
She's a dance teacher, right?
She is. Yeah. She's a choreographer and a performer. Yeah. So
She both. So you must be fucking good at the salsa then.
Mate, honestly, I've got two left feet. I don't ask her to play rugby. She doesn't ask me to dance. So yeah, we're all good.
Look, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your story. Yeah. I know, obviously, you've been outspoken on a few platforms now about what you've been through and obviously coming out with the RPA and getting help, etc. So I really, really appreciate you sharing your story.
Oh, no worries, mate. It's a privilege to be a part of it. And yeah, what you're doing is awesome. So yeah, I'm just stoked to be involved.
Segues pretty nice into the question I ask most people. Why did you want to come on the podcast?
Yeah, well, exactly that. I think the initiative that you sort of checked out there about what you're trying to do, mate, is an awesome one. And I just thought if I can help in any way, then I'd be stoked to be able to do so. I've had a bit of experience, like you already touched on, with speaking and sharing my story on the various platforms, and have sort of seen that the impact that can have on people's lives when it's, you know, really just me sharing some of my struggles. And so from that, I've found I've been humbled a lot in terms of how much it has helped other people. And so any chance that I get to share that story in any sort of capacity is I guess a privilege in my view to hopefully at least help, you know, someone else in similar shoes that we've found ourselves in at times.
Nice.
And give them a sense of commonality in their experience and also a sense of hope that they can get through it. So
mate, nice, like it. Your story is very interesting. Obviously playing rugby in New Zealand, making your way over to the Premiership. Was it Queens, Tigers, Worcester?
It was yeah. Tigers.
Right, Tigers, Queens, Worcester.
Worcester for a loan for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Quinns, Worcester, yeah. So
right, okay.
It was kind of a there was a period of about maybe 3 or 4 months where I managed to play for three different Prem teams. So it was,
yeah, you've had the full spread of the English countryside, really, or not so in Quinns. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah, that's exactly right. So no, it's been enjoyable since being over here. It's definitely a different experience than back home in lots of ways. But the Premiership competition in some aspects is the most thriving competition I've been involved with in terms of the fans that still turn up to games, etc., and probably the level of competition in Super Rugby at the moment. There's there has been up until probably this year, the start of this year at least, a great divide between the top and bottom of the table. But in the Premier League over the last wee while, it's just getting more and more competitive. So it's been enjoyable.
Yeah, as a Crusaders fan, I've been enjoying the last 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, I'm from Fashion, so
No, look, let's go into your story because it's fascinating. Where did this all start?
Mate, it started when I was around 19, 11, 12. Is obviously in those years you don't necessarily keep a log diary of the exact moments, but I have the memories for sure. I can sort of speak about the different fields that it happened in, in my memory that they took place in the areas in my house or whatever. So all that happened for me was I had a couple experiences with my dad. When I was a kid, there was probably two major things in my story that led to some mental health struggles. I'll share in depth about one of them. One of them being around some things that happened with my dad. We have a really great relationship. I've talked to him about all the stuff. He's apologized for the stuff that he needed to, and we've dealt with the rest of it. He's a great dad. I'm blessed to have him in my life. But there were some moments in my life, I guess, I misinterpreted, and some other moments he has put his hand up and said he made a mistake that as a kid I sort of internalized and read into some situations that led me to think in certain ways about myself and about the world around me that meant that I started to create some unhealthy thought habits. Those instances that are some of them that I can remember. One time and this is probably the one he put his hand up and said it was a mistake of his. I was playing a game. I probably wasn't playing too well. I was 11 or 12 at the time. And he sort of walked onto the pitch and said, if you don't start making tackles, I'll take you off and we'll go home. And in front of my mates and the parents and stuff like that, my teammates' parents and everything else, I was pretty embarrassed and obviously a little bit ashamed. And then on top of that, around that period of time, any games that I didn't play particularly well, I'd get in the car. Even those moments didn't really happen often. In fact, that was probably the only time I can remember that happened. But these moments happen more often. If I didn't play too well, I'd get in the car, he'd be driving me home, and nothing would be said. And then I remember that nothing would be said for a reasonable amount of time. In fact, some instances I can remember nothing being said between us until the day after on the Sunday.
Wow.
And so both of those moments caused me to internalize this idea that my dad had lost love for me, or stopped loving me as much, because I had made mistakes on the rugby field. So for me, basically what I was saying was that this game that I was playing at this point in time for fun, obviously, even though it was just for fun, the mistakes in a fun game were big enough in my dad's eyes for him to stop loving me as much. And so in my mind I thought, well, that must mean that my performance is crucial in order for people to love me. In fact, I'd go so far as to say I decided to believe in my mind without realizing it that my complete worth was attached to how I performed.
If you take yourself back there, I mean, how did you feel as a 9, 10, 11 year old, if you can remember being in those situations? What did it actually feel like?
Yeah, because it was definitely, I can remember the times most memorable around 12 or 13. And obviously there's you're starting to become a lot more self-aware as a kid, teenager at that time. And I guess I started to feel really, first and foremost, I felt real sad and upset about the fact that I thought that my dad didn't love me as much in those moments specifically, but also therefore I thought he mustn't love me as much quite often because I make mistakes quite often. So I started to feel pressure, I guess, and a sense of anxiety as well, because I felt like now I needed to be perfect in every situation, regardless of whether it was sport or whatever, to make sure that not just my dad, but everyone around me loved me, to love me in the same capacity. Because I obviously didn't just go in my head cognitively, or I wasn't doing it consciously, but subconsciously I didn't go in my head, oh, that's just how dad operates with me. I in my head thought, well, dad is someone who's meant to love me the most. So he obviously does love me the most. So if that's the way he's with me, then how much worse are people around me, like friends and stuff like that, going to judge me for my mistakes if that's the case? So I attached that to everyone, which meant that I became a lot more anxious. I became a lot more determined in the sense of wanting to be perfect. I became a lot more serious. My parents even said, like, at the age of about 12 or 13, they were like, something just clicked inside of you where you became you went from this like happy-go-lucky kid to the super serious kid who in every moment had to be had to sort of concentrate on all the finer details and wow. Couldn't pull himself out of it just to enjoy it. It was about trying to be, and they didn't know at the time, but that was because I was just trying to be perfect. And so I was analyzing all the situations and trying to make sure that I was limiting the amount of mistakes or completely eradicating them from every situation. So what I didn't realize was one, that was unhealthy, and two, that wasn't actually true of my situation. My dad did actually love me very much. He just isn't the perfect person either. And what I didn't realize, and only realized later in my journey when I sort of talked to him about it, was that although the moment of him coming onto the field and saying and dragging me off, or saying he was going to drag me off, was a mistake of his, and he apologized and asked for forgiveness for that, which was healing tremendously in lots of ways. The other parts of him not speaking to me was because he was really worried that he would share his opinion with me really emotionally straight after a game. Because he gets caught up in the emotion of his kids playing sport or whatever else, or competing or achieving in anything. That his worry was that the emotion would come across in some unloving way, and so ironically his decision was, I'll give my son space to actually figure it out for himself and let him come to me to speak to me once he's ready to. If that meant 24 hours of space, that's just what he was committed to giving. The awkward dynamic being that I didn't interpret it that way. I just interpreted that my dad wasn't talking to me anymore, and that must mean he doesn't love me as much. For him, it was actually his way of trying to show me love and give me space to actually process things in my own time and way. So I guess that in hindsight became healing, because it sort of showed me that wasn't his intention. But in the moment, obviously I wasn't interpreting it in that way. And so I sort of started to run around with a lot of a different with a very unhealthy mindset that started to plague my experience in lots of different ways, like we've touched on already, especially in terms of the anxiety attached to the way I did everyday life and the pressure that I put on myself to be perfect. Yeah.
Interesting. We then move into playing, I presume, semi-professional rugby and professional rugby in New Zealand from the age of like 15, 16, 17. And that's when it took hold of your life and your behaviors to another level, right?
Yeah. So I guess because those moments went unchecked, and then, you know, like I didn't go and process them with accounts or anything at the time because I didn't know any better.
No.
I sort of ran with those thought patterns and habits throughout my life, developing life from there on in. So through my teenage years at high school and stuff like that. And it got to a point at the age of, I'd say my birthday is in March, and the height of my depression, I remember, was around June, July, August of 2011, which would have put me at 19. But I would say the starting initial period of that depression and onset of it would have started within March. So around 18, 19 years old, where I started to, deteriorate mentally. And at the same time, I'd finished high school a year and a half ago, and I'd moved into a club rugby, which is still amateur in New Zealand, but club rugby works in a different way in New Zealand, where even if you're involved in a super rugby team, if you're not playing that weekend for your super rugby team, you're actually going back to your suburb or club that you sort of affiliate with, whether it's the one you grew up in, or if you're in a different region, then it might be one that you've just been put into, and play for that club team. So club competition's quite a strong competition. It's used for development of professional players. And
we're talking like Hawke's Bay, North Harbour, those sort of
players. That's Mitre 10. So that's actually semi-pro. Below that is like you're literally playing suburban rugby. So Premiership suburban rugby would look like the 14 biggest suburbs in Christchurch City. Would play off against each other, but they might be 5 minutes down the road from each other. So you need to travel more than 30-40 minutes to play a club game. That's probably the best way I can describe it. The suburbs are more of a, I guess, New Zealand, American thing than they are in English, where you're more so done by postcode, etc. But yeah, that's the idea of it. And so I was playing there, and things were going pretty well. I actually... remember, I think we've alluded to this before, but I remember after about two or three games playing for the Open men's team, as a 19-year-old, I got made captain, which was surprising because there were guys that were way more worthy of being the leader of the team at the time, and had played a lot more games than me, some over 100, and for whatever reason, the coaches picked me to be captain, and that was about 2 hours before the game. They told me probably not to get too much of a level of anxiety up for the fact that if I built into it during the week. And I just remember that was at the same time as being, so this was around June time, but being really, really depressed. And I remember having such a high, being told I was going to be captain, playing that game, being involved in a rugby game where my brain was having a break and I wasn't thinking about all the depressive thoughts and stuff that were going on at the time, which I will do in a second. Finishing the game, being super excited, whatever, and then as soon as I got into my car straight after that game, I just bawled my eyes out all the way home. 30-minute drive home, I just was a wreck because I was confronted with everything that I was dealing with again. And so I went from this massive high to this just massive and basically what I started to face was that I guess I got myself to a point in time at the age of 18 where I had not dealt with any of these things and actually allowed them more and more of a root in my mind, I guess, that I had become super anxious, super worried all the time, super stressed, because I was literally trying to avoid mistakes everywhere I went, which is just impossible. And I was also dwelling on all of the consequences, I thought, of those mistakes, so that, you know, parents wouldn't love me as much, family wouldn't love me as much, friends wouldn't love me as much, you know, people I needed to pick me in a rugby game wouldn't value me as a rugby player as much because I was making mistakes the week before. Just across the board, I was going to university, all the rest, and it just became too much, and I think my brain just couldn't handle it anymore and started to sort of deteriorate. And what I started to notice in my experience was that I started to really, really seriously hate myself. I started to really, really hate the idea of waking up in the morning and having to push through the day because of the amount of depressive thoughts that I was met with every morning and then throughout the rest of the day. And
what kind of thoughts were you met with? I think that's interesting to explore.
Yeah, well, a number, I guess, but a lot of them were centered around hating myself, hating what I was and what I thought I could become, or would become, I guess, and destined to become. And they were, I found myself a lot dwelling on my past and the mistakes I've made, plus some things that, plus I guess the way that the future was going to look based on those mistakes. And then some other things, I guess, that were attached to some other sense of trauma that I had during my teenage years, I guess, there was that as well, and I definitely hadn't dealt with that. And so there were all these, I guess, a mix of incredibly negative thoughts that I would get up in the morning and just be confronted with. And I got to the point where I felt like my life was going to continue. Like, I tried a few things myself personally without telling anyone about it, just thinking like, no, that you know, like I told myself, it'll pass away. It's just a moment in time, one of those weeks. But those weeks turned into a month, and that month turned into 2 months. And then all of a sudden I'm at June, and I'm in a place where I'm like, I don't actually see how this is going to ever change or get better. And if that's the case, I just do not want to carry on living like this. Like, I'd prefer to be dead than to face this every day. It's too hard. It's just so much. It's so much of a struggle. It's like exhausting.
Yeah.
To get out in the day and try and fight myself through to the finish line, which is when I get back to sleep. And so I've said this a few times in various platforms, but yeah, I never attempted, but there was two reasons for that. I couldn't fathom what it would do to my family, specifically my parents especially, but also my brothers and sister. And I couldn't do that to them, but also because of my faith, I didn't feel like my life was my own to be able to take into my hands. And so I got stuck in this position of sort of wishing and fantasizing about things that could happen to me that would take it out of my own hands, like, you know, like walking across a road and a car accidentally hitting me or something like that, and that being the way out, I guess. And that was very real. I don't say that lightly, because I know you can speculate about these things or whatever, but no, that was something that was I still think about it pretty clearly now and think how incredibly dark the place I was in at the time.
How do you reflect back on that?
How do I reflect on it?
Yeah.
In lots of ways. Most of my hindsight now, looking at that, if not all of it, is really positive, which is weird to say, but I can explain that further. Essentially, yeah. I look back at it now and go, man, it was so dark. I can't believe I was like that. But I can see why. I can see clearly actually now, which I couldn't always say this, even maybe 2 years ago, I couldn't say this, because I'm 28 now, just for context. So it's been nearly 10 years. Yeah. But yeah, I look back on those moments and think, man, I was in a really deep, dark place, but how much joy I have in the fact that I can say that I'm nowhere near that now, I guess. And the journey that I've sort of been able to go on because of that, because of being in that dark place, I'm very, very thankful for, ironically and weirdly, I guess, but I'm really thankful for that. I went through that time for the fact that I became more self-aware and was able to actually deal with lots of problems that I had faced in my childhood and my teenage years and whatever else. But also it meant that I could become just more aware of who I was as a person. And ultimately, I would think as well, it's given me an opportunity to share a story that has been able to help people. And it's like I said at the start, it's quite humbling, because it's not me talking about something I did well or that I was strong in. It's me just going, hey, I struggled here, and yet people find hope in that. And that's incredibly humbling, and it's an incredible privilege to be able to be part of. So yeah, I look back at it mostly with fondness, but at the same time with a huge amount of almost just being shocked when I really think about it, about, man, I was in a really deep, dark hole at the time, and it was a really hard place to find myself. Yeah.
How did it affect your rugby?
This is the thing, man. I don't know whether you are similar or not. I guess it's different for everyone, but for some people, I've definitely known it's been the same, that I remain quite high functioning, and I wasn't seeing the world on fire on the rugby field, but I was definitely performing at that point some of the best rugby up to that point in my life. And university was going really well, and otherwise no one would have known, and they didn't for up until probably I can't remember exactly when, but it would have been a lot longer later on in that year when finally someone found out what was going on when I told them. no one would have had a clue because I was high enough functioning to, for everything to seem completely normal. And I think that's the scary thing, is that the symptoms are quite hard to see in a person unless they elaborate to you how they're actually feeling.
Yeah,
but also I think, I guess in some ways it's an interesting thing to sort of ponder about why it is that people can be in a really deep, dark place emotionally, mentally, and still manage to turn up in a physically and do what they've got to do. And I think that the other thing that sticks out to me in those times is it almost added to my level of depression and like almost went around in circles and made things worse because I was like, look how good my life is going. Look how things are going so well. How could you be upset with your life? How could you be wanting to not be alive anymore when there are so many people struggling more than you are situationally, and yet you're struggling mentally and they're not? Like, shame on you. And especially as a man, you know, like, shame on you for feeling sad, and shame on you for feeling sad when things are so good, being ungrateful, all those thoughts start to, you know, fly around my head, which only makes you more sad, ironically, which then makes that circle start all over again. So yeah, I think that was part of the problem as well. Yeah.
We are Loose Heads, the rugby leisurewear brand, helping to raise awareness for mental health.
100% of the money raised by our foundation goes towards tackling the stigma.
You can find us at looseheads.co.uk or at looseheads on all social media platforms. You can now enter code RUT for 10% off your next order. Together, let's tackle the stigma. Take care. Go safe.
You touched on very, very briefly there when you started talking to somebody. Really, for me, to obviously the point of this podcast is to get men to talk about what they've gone through. Talking for you was the beginning of, it was the start of it getting a lot better and seeking help. I mean, why did you begin to talk about it and walk through that experience talking about it for the first time?
Yeah, so my mindset at the time, moving forward before, like preceding, I guess, speaking about it, was that it was like I was feeling like I've already said, a lot of shame attached to what I was going through, and I felt like I was alone in what I was struggling with, and therefore there was no one who was going to understand what I was dealing with, and people would treat me differently if they knew. So I hadn't said to myself that I was depressed or anything like that. I didn't know. I just thought I was, like I didn't know what it was, but I was just not good. And my mindset around that was, if I got myself into this mess somehow, I don't know how I did, but if I found myself in this mess, that I would get myself out of it. And the naive notion of that was, again, that isolated me to just to my own problems, to carry it myself and to deal with it myself in secrecy, in shame. And that wasn't even going to lead to a positive result. And so I was really lucky one moment in time that my parents were in their room, and I walked down the hallway just to sort of talk to them that evening for whatever reason. And they turned the conversation on me and said, like, how are you going? And I think at that point in time, I remember at that point in time, I was just so tired, like, incredibly tired of trying to survive, which is what it felt like. That for the first time, rather than just saying all good, uni's going well and stuff like that, which I'd said so often to so many people, I just actually said, not good, eh? Like, I think that's exactly what I said, not good, eh? Like, I didn't say, like, I'm terrible, I hate life, and but all that. I just said, I'm not good. And their response, I remember, was, yeah, we know, we could tell. What's going on? Yeah, and obviously they had noticed a change in me gradually, emotionally, if not with physical, situational life, I guess.
It's funny when people say they're fine, because I don't know if you've heard the acronym, the FINE acronym, which is fucked up, insecure, neurotic, and emotional, which is basically, which is basically blokes being like, yeah, I'm fine, I'm really not.
No, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Exactly that. I think I was just, they were willing as parents to wait for me to elaborate to them, which was, I suppose, really gracious of them and thoughtful, but ballsy as well because of where I was at the time.
It's touch and go, that.
yeah. But I guess they had faith that in the end I would sort of elaborate to them when I needed to, and I did. So I'm sure they would have pushed the envelope a lot more if they saw things getting worse. But yeah, they sort of said, what's going on? I elaborated to them what was going on, and then they said, look, I think you need to seriously consider getting some help. I think they even mentioned getting counselling at the end. I was like, no way. Like, you know, I got myself, like I said.
Why did you react like that to counselling? That's so interesting.
Because of the stereotype and the stigma attached to what I was admitting to, because of where I was in my life, because I was a 19-year-old man and I or boy, or a mixture of both, I guess, emotionally.
Yeah. Man child.
Yeah. But no, I said to myself that this is not something you want to make extremely public. This is not something that you want to admit even to yourself that is real, because going to a counselor does that. Going to a counselor says that you've got problems that you need to deal with. Going to a counselor says that you've got emotional problems that you need to deal with, and that's not particularly popular in the rugby world, and even in, you know, male New Zealand society, that's not popular. I guess it's similar to most Western cultures in the world. Males are not necessarily encouraged to explore their emotions or mention their emotions when they're negative, unless it's anger, which is macho, but certainly sadness, crying, things like that, and not macho at all. So in this stereotypical world. Mm. And so I guess that was why I said no. I guess there was a sense of pride going, no, I can do this. Like, I can help myself and get myself out of this and carry the burden myself, which I couldn't. The good thing was, I guess, that I realized in the moment of sharing my struggles with them that I felt better, and I just couldn't say why, other than I just felt like someone understood and cared for me enough now that they always cared for me, but could care for my situation specifically.
Someone's now looking out for you in this typical situation. Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. And to that end, I felt like I was finally, you know, not alone in my struggle.
What impact did that have on you?
Well, I guess in some ways it had every impact in terms of where I am now. And I'd say like it was a turning point in the sense that from that moment on, since then, little by little, I've made steps away from that horrendous point that I found myself right before it. And although those increments were very hard to see day by day in the gains, I look back and now with hindsight and see this gaping gap between those two people and realize that, yeah, that was the moment where I guess I turned around and started walking out the other direction. And what was probably the biggest part of that was, like I said, it probably took the problem that felt like it was just mine, and it took the shame that I felt was horrendously attached to what I was dealing with, and it got rid of the shame because I recognized that there was my parents reacted in the same way they had always reacted with me, which was with love and care and support. And obviously it also felt like no longer was this journey just my own to deal with, but there were people around me who could do it with me, which made it feel like perhaps there's a sense of hope that this could get better. And then through them knowing, other people began to, my story is, I can go into great detail if you want, but there were some people that came in my mum, who she knew, who then started to share with me their stories of similar struggles. They then gave me even more specific hope, I guess, because I could attach my story to their story and see the similarities and put them through it. And the journey, like I said, started to, I guess, gather some momentum in that sense. So like I said, from my parents finding out, other people came on board in my life that could help. Mm-hmm. And then later on, I guess a lot later on, I found myself in counselling, I guess, which is the next part of the journey. But yeah, that was what
happened. And when did you find yourself? Were you over in the UK at that stage?
No, so counselling. So I was I in 2013. I moved to Bay of Plenty to play Minor Ten Cup.
Yeah.
At the end of 2013, so I played the 2014 season and 2015 season. At the start of 2015, while I was still in the Bay of Plenty, I signed for Leicester Tigers.
Yeah.
And remained in my contract at the Bay of Plenty to finish that out before arriving in October. In
what was that feeling like, signing for Tigers?
Oh, mate, it was huge. It was, you only had to type it in on Google and see what sort of when or what is attached to, certainly what was attached to Leicester then, but still is in some ways. To the team and everything that goes with it, to know that it was a huge privilege, I guess, to be involved in going over there to play, and also just a huge amount of excitement, I guess, and a change of scenery and first time living outside of New Zealand. Oh, it was a whole bunch. I mean, a whole bunch. There was a lot of nerves attached as well.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah.
because I was leaving home for the first time and stuff like that. And I guess that was part of what pushed me, nudged me forward even more so into counselling, because I had recognised that although I was a lot better mentally at that stage, I definitely wasn't in the place of being, of fantasising about suicide all the time. There were still a lot of moments where I get down and that it would cross my mind to a lower level. I was not like I was in 2011, but I was at the stage it was 2015. I was still not out of the woods by any stretch of the imagination. And
mate, I can relate to that as well. Like, there's still times where I get down and it's a thought that comes into my head. Whereas for others, it's like, what the hell is going on? Actually, it's kind of normalized.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. And so I thought to myself, well, I'm about to leave a country where all my family and friends and support network are. And if I haven't actually figured out ways to get on top of this in a more specific to Jono kind of way, rather than just play a bit of, you know, all the things that are really good that we should do, especially if we're struggling, like play sport, eat healthy, meditation, or for me, prayer, all these things that they encourage you to do that helps with mental health. If I haven't actually given my journey some specific help, I guess I figured it was not necessarily going to go well for me. So I,
before you went to counseling though, obviously you're in a better place, and there's a period of time where you've spoken to your parents about this and then you've gone into counseling, but you'd got better and better. Was that literally through talking? You mentioned the Jono specific way. What were the ways in which you coped?
Yeah. So, big part was basically my mum, once she found out what I was struggling with, took it really hard because she's caring for a kid, obviously. And there was a moment in church where she was bawling her eyes out, and a lady comes up to speak to her, asks if she's okay, and she just says, oh, I've just had sort of found out my son is struggling really bad. Excuse me. And this woman basically said, which son is this? I didn't know at the time. I was actually about to go around to her house for the first time in my life. With a whole bunch of our mates were invited to hers for lunch. And she said, oh, my son, Jono, blah, blah, blah. And she was like, oh, okay. What's he struggling with? And she mentioned my story and what I was dealing with, like in depression and stuff like that. And she said, oh, my son's sort of just journeying his way out of that. I'd love to meet up with him sometime, and I would be happy to talk to him about that and sort of give him a sense that there's some hope. And his story is actually almost identical in terms of the stuff that he's dealing with mentally and what's going on through his head. So I'd love to sit down with him and just help any way I can. I then, without knowing my mum's even had this conversation, went to her house for lunch. And at the end, she started talking about her son, and then talking about what was going on there. And then actually, I think she made mention of the fact that he had once struggled with depression. He was about, 10 years older than me. And I, for whatever reason, said, I guess because I felt comfortable and because I just started sharing about it, said, look, I myself am actually struggling. She's like, what's your name? I was like, oh, my name's Jono. She's like, is your mum Bev? And I was like, yeah. She's like, I just spoke to her this morning, actually, and said that I was going to meet up with you and talk. She's like, I need to have a word with you. And so,
that is amazing. What a coincidence.
No, mate. So we started we started a discussion.
And mate, this shit happens for a reason.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. So we started talking for a good few months over the phone, and then she'd sometimes I go around her house and have discussions with her about her son or various things, but she just stayed connected with me and tried to share the journey with me in that sense, her journey with her son, what helped him. And that was a initial stages of something that really helped me, I guess, because again, I had now a specific story that I could relate to, that of a guy who also went through what I went through and came out the other side. So it attached a lot of hope to my story, and also felt like personal now that I had someone who was going to be there for through that journey with me, etc.
It's an amazing act of kindness, really, from her perspective. Like,
incredible, mate. And that's why and that's why I guess we see now lots of things, you know, people saying, I'm happy to just listen, I'm happy to talk.
Yeah.
Because I think we don't realize, you know, for me, it was my parents just saying, hey, we noticed you're not the same as you usually are. And there was this lady just saying, you know, like, well, inviting me around to her house first for lunch, but then just sharing a bit of her story, having a conversation, and then actually being confident enough to say, oh, you know, ask me your name, and then put two and two together and all the rest. And then being willing to invite me into parts of her life, I guess, which she didn't have to. Which is probably, you know, part of the reason why I stand here today. I guess what happened then was I started a journey where I started to get better because of, I guess, the added hope that I had that things were going to get better. I didn't feel so locked in the dread of this is never going to get better. The only way out is dying. I felt like, no, things could get better by actually my mind healing. And I don't know how that's going to happen, but I know it can happen. And so I'm committed to finding out how. And even that, in a sense, is a turnaround point in itself, and makes things better in your mind, because the loss of hope is something that, I guess, drags you even further down. It's like, if there's no answer to this, then what is the point? But the moment it becomes like, oh, no, there is an answer, there is a way where this could get better, then, okay, I'm going to pursue that and commit myself to pursuing that, which is the way I went down. Once that started to get better, I felt really, I felt it like it was, the way I describe it is I almost felt like there was some form of, I don't even know how to describe it. I've never really tried to, I guess. There was something compelling in me inside myself. I would say, obviously, God compelling me to share my story. And I didn't know why. I didn't necessarily think to myself, it's going to help a lot of people or anything like that. I thought that perhaps if I've got help from this guy's story, that it may help one or two people. I might share it once or twice and that be that. And so I was lucky enough to share my story first and foremost at church in front of people of all ages. And
wow.
And that was difficult, because even in church environment, sadly, I'm sort of grieved to say, up until recently, and even still in some cases, it's not even a topic that's really spoken about in church or...
No, of course.
A lot of light on, because historically, religion has been about saving face. And although that's not what Christian church should look like in terms of religious and saving face, it still is in a lot of ways, some places. And so there's a sense of fear about, again, what people would think and what people would say, because it's not, you know, admitting that as a Christian you suffer with depression is not necessarily, is like also probably saying I'm a male playing a male who plays rugby and I suffer with depression. It's probably on a similar level. But I shared it and had amazing response. I had a 6-year-old lady come up to me in tears saying, I've been waiting for years for someone to get up in church and share their story of similar to what I've been through, and it's given me hope, and it's just been so helpful to me. I had another lady a lot younger come up to me and say, I needed to hear that. That's, you know, helped me to no end, to, or something to like that effect. And I thought, oh man, like, okay, I thought it might help one or two, but then the story sort of keeps flooding through. And I guess I also, at the end of it, felt a huge sense of positivity because of that, because of the positive reactions I'd had from it. I sensed inside myself, like, oh man, there is an element of what I've been through here that it is actually going to help others if I do share this. And if I didn't go through that, I'd never have this. So I actually feel slightly blessed and slightly, well, greatly blessed. And I feel like this is actually something that's going to add to me in a lot of ways. And so I sort of started to develop this idea that what this moment in time that I was experiencing or had experienced and still was in some ways experiencing was actually going to be something that worked out for my good in the long run, and not something that was going to rob me of my life and rob me of my sort of quality of life. And so from that, I started sort of, anyone who asked me to share my story, I was quite happy to. I shared it with my mates and things like that, and the response was always really positive. I managed to, my degree was in sports coaching, and part of that was exploring like psychology and sports psychology. And there was a moment of talking and also sport injuries, and then injuries included mental injuries, so depression associated with sport. And I volunteered to share about my own personal struggles with depression in that context. So I shared that in my class at uni. And again, all positive responses. And it wasn't necessarily something I look back on and pat myself on the back for, because again, there's nothing really to pat myself on the back for in the sense that I was sharing about my struggles, but that I was just really compelled to share my story, in the sense that if it could help one person, like I've said already, that it was worth it, regardless of any negative sort of connotations that might come from it from other people.
Yeah. I also think, arguably, Jono, like most importantly, and this you could argue against this, but most importantly, probably it's been the most help has been for yourself. What I found with sharing my story is that, yes, I know that it hopefully will have an impact on other people, but actually for me, continually to verbalize it into the fucking wall or something, like it makes such a difference talking about it. And yeah, so
yeah,
most importantly, it's going to be helpful for you.
Yeah. So yeah, exactly that. And then I think that another sort of big encouragement for me to share the story before I finally ended up at counseling was, I moved to the Bay of Plenty, and again, for whatever reason, it was something that happened at church, but a guy came who I'd never met before. He sort of looked at me while he was speaking on stage at the end of his sermon, and he said, God sort of says to me that you've got a story a lot like John Kirwan's, and it's along the lines of like, all things can work for good for those that love God, which is a verse that he was sort of quoting. And he said, I feel like you need to share that story. It's something that you need to share to people, because it's going to bring, healing, like you've said, both to yourself and to others. And I was like, mate, there's no way you could know that. That's my story. Like, I've never met you before. So I'm going to take that on board, and I'm going to trust that is from God, based on my beliefs. And so that was sort of like the final sort of encouragement and direction I needed for me to be like, this is something that I should do. And so, from there on, there were moments that I got to share at churches and schools and stuff like that in New Zealand. But in at the same time, because I was still in that place of dealing with it, there was probably the last little bit of the story that needed, well, I mean, I think it'll be something that will be a journey for the rest of my life in some sense, but the last bit of, I guess, the healing part of my journey in regards to actually understanding what was going on was about to unfold in terms of going to counseling, because that was in 2014, and my counseling started early 2015. So, yeah.
What was your experience of counseling?
So, my counselor sort of asked me, straight away, I did like a little bit of a survey on the first day, and I remember walking in feeling like, I kind of need counseling, but I kind of don't. I'm going to do it because I know I want to get this like completely on top of this. I know I want to sort of understand myself a bit better, so that if I get put in really sticky situations in the UK away from home, that I've got some tools that I can really apply to my mind that are going to help. And I walked in and did the survey. She asked me a bunch of questions, whatever, to sort of help her go forward in the sessions that we're going to follow. And I remember finishing that survey and getting into my car and bawling my eyes out like I hadn't since probably back in 2011 for probably close to an hour, getting on the phone with my parents back home in Christchurch and basically I think what the big one, the big reason was, I one of the questions was, are you suicidal? And I said, no, like not like I was in 2011. No, I'm not suicidal. She's like, okay, have you in the last week had like a passing thought about death and about it being like a relief? And I was like, probably, yeah. And she's like, would you say even in the last like 3 days? And I was like, yeah, I have, but it's not like a, I want that. It's more like a thought that comes into my head, and
it's just normalized, right?
And it's normalized, like you were just saying earlier. So I was like, yeah, it's a normal thing for me, I guess. I kind of just accepted that it's gonna in some ways be there. She's like, no, like I would still say that that's not a healthy place to be in. So I'm gonna say in that sense that you are suicidal, not that you are planning it, not that you're in the stages of trying to actually commit it, but that you are, there are still like fantasies about in your mind, and that's not a healthy place that we want to find ourselves in the future. So I'm going to write that in. And I just remember being like, oh my gosh, I'm still here. Like, yeah. I am still like, that's true. And that is real. And perhaps that's not going to like, not a good place to be. And then just being hit with the weight of, yeah, like I am still sad. And my general quality of life is still not as great as it was before I started this whole depressive episode. And I have sort of accepted a new normal, which is nowhere close to what it used to, what my life used to look like when I was, you know, 11. Yeah. And so perhaps there are lots of areas of my life that still need to be addressed. And so then the next session was, she sat me in front of a mirror and said, I want you to say, she's like, you've just signed a contract to Leicester Tigers, which means that, you know, you could say, let's just for argument's sake, say that you're in the top 5% of rugby players in the world. And it could be slightly less, it could be slightly more, it doesn't really matter, but that means that you could at least say that you're a good rugby player. You know, like, it's not saying you're the best, it's not saying you're even great, you're just going to say you're a good rugby player. And I was like, not a chance will I ever say that to myself, especially looking myself in the eyes and actually having to acknowledge it in some weird way that has an effect on you by looking yourself in the mirror. I just can't do it. And she said, why? And I was like, well, you haven't seen all the mistakes I've made. You haven't seen all the things that the coaches say, even coaches right now that I'm playing for in Bay of Plenty. You haven't seen how my dad's reacted to the games that I played in the past and all these things that happened in the past and blah, blah, blah. And she said, like, don't you think though, factually, you have to admit that you are a good rugby player? And I knew inside myself, I was like, I know factually that I can't really say no to that. It's actually almost a bit, again, ungrateful if I don't say that, because there are people who are killed for what I have and the opportunity that I have, and who would 100% admit that I would be a good rugby player and say that. So there's no way I can really argue or get around that, but it feels so foreign to me that it might as well not be true. In fact, that I want to fight for the fact that it isn't true. I feel so defended in my thought process around how I'm such a crap rugby player and I'm no good at rugby whatsoever. And again, that's based on mistakes, performance, all the rest. And then she said, well, can we slightly go off tack here and then go, let's talk about you as a person. Can you say that you're a good person, that you're loved by your family, that you're loved by, you know, in this instance, God or whatever? And I said to her, no, like, you, that's even harder for me to admit, because you've not seen all the things that I've thought, things that I've done, all the wrong, you know, all the things that I've done wrong to people, etc. And I could list off things, you know, like in my mind. So I was like, I'll never be able to say I'm, you know, like a good person and that I'm loved and for just for who I am. Like, you haven't seen the mistakes I made. And she said, well, can we now acknowledge, you know, like, she said, I've sat here with you now for an hour and a half, nearly 2 hours, and I can already see that you're a good person who's worthy of being loved, who's worthy of actually being able to think good things about themselves. And I know then that would be true for other people around you who you spend your time with, whether it be your family, with your friends, etc. And she was like, so can you now see that there are some really unhealthy, toxic ways of thinking in your mind that are so habitual in the way that you ascribe to them that you don't even question them or think twice, that that's just the status quo of the way you see yourself and the way you see the world? And that these thought patterns are perhaps the reason why you're finding yourself in a place of depression, because they're so toxic, they're so damaging, they release so much negativity in terms of, like, even chemically in your brain, that no wonder it's struggling to cope and struggling to deal with a logical, healthy way of dealing with information and dealing with thoughts. Like a brain that's not struggling with depression does. And that obviously hit me like a ton of bricks, like quite sobering to think actually the way I think about myself is not truthful and is not helpful and is not healthy. But it was the best thing that ever happened, because it started this journey of walking down a road of self-discovery, I guess, in lots of ways, of seeing all these patterns in my life of thinking that I had for a long, long time that had built up over a long period of time because of situations that had happened in my life. You know, some low key situations. I'm not saying my life was hugely traumatic, but there was trauma that happened in my life that was mid to low level and some a little bit higher, whatever, that I just didn't deal with. And in the moment, didn't think about properly, interpreted in the wrong way, that had led me to completely change the way I viewed myself. And years later had sort of led me to depression. And so what then eventuated, I guess, was a attempt and a good attempt at starting to rewrite my thought patterns in my life, actually try and recalibrate and renew my mind in a sense that I was going to acknowledge that these things that I was thinking about myself weren't true, and then try and actually think about a real true way about the way I was in replacement of those thoughts, so that then I'd start to create a new healthy habit in replacement, I guess, and that those good habits, I guess, would start to be autonomized in my mind, and eventually I'd have a really healthy mind because I was thinking to myself and the world around me in a really healthy way. And that would improve my experience with depression and anxiety and stress and all those things as a result. And that's probably where I stand today. The further counseling I had when I moved to the UK, and then even when I moved back home, sort of examined where those thoughts actually first came from, including this first counseling I had in the Bay of Pinier as well. But over the next, from 2015 basically to 2018, I think what happened was I acknowledged with my counselor that there was these toxic thoughts going on that were harming me, but then started to go, okay, well, why? Like, why? Where have they come from? What caused them? What do I need to do to actually address them in a holistic way? Not just to get rid of them, but to actually ask myself why they came in the first place, why they were so strong in my like emotional part of my mind and obviously the mental part. Why they had such a weight on who I was as a person and the way I view the world. And obviously we arrived at some answers, like, okay, so I see all my mistakes quite clearly and judge myself based on these mistakes quite clearly. And that leads me to stress and anxiety because I believe that my worth is determined by how I perform. And I believe that my worth is determined by how I perform. She would say, okay, well, why do you think that? And I'd be like, oh, I don't know. And they're like, really? Like, when was the first time you felt like your worth was defined by your performance? And I'd be like, oh, I can't really think about that. And she's like, I'm sure you could. Like, when was a moment where you felt like it was really unfair that you were judged for something that you didn't mean to do, that was just a mistake? And then I was like, this moment here with my dad, blah, 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 you know. Like, and then all of a sudden she's like, there we go, you know. She's like, I would encourage you to actually deal with that in a really healthy way. First and foremost, she's like, what's your relationship with your dad now? Could you go and speak to him about that? I said, yeah, of course I could. So I went to dad and I said, look, man, back this time, do you remember this happening? He either did or he didn't, but regardless, he said, yeah, I can acknowledge that would have happened. I'm really sorry. He said, I'm really sorry that I did that. I'm really sorry that I reacted that way. I ask that you forgive me for those moments. I've always loved you, and I've always loved you not for what you have done, but for who you are and the fact that you're my son. Obviously, there's a few tears and everything else that went on.
It's amazing.
Well, it took that's why I'm so lucky to have the dad I have, because that's why she probably asked, can you have that conversation with your dad? Because some
people
aren't that lucky to be able to return to the scene of the crime, so to speak, I guess, and deal with it in that way. But there are still other ways to deal with it. She obviously went on and said the other part that's really crucial is that you grieve it, in a way that you didn't in those moments as a kid.
Mm.
Because if you don't, like, grievance is the, you know, mind's natural response of actually trying to deal with the initial emotion that comes from something that hurts. And then as part of the actual process of, well, I guess, processing that emotion in a way that leads you to not actually internalizing that emotion like I did, and then running with a really unhealthy way of thinking about the world or yourself, ongoing from there on in. And so that was part of it, having to deal with that trauma, I guess. And then from that, then I had to go and say to myself, okay, well, now can you see why you picked up those thoughts and they feel so true to you, yet that they are actually not true? Because look how your dad responded. Even if he didn't respond in the way and said, no, it was your fault because you suck and you're a no good rugby player and you're a no good person, she could still say, but okay, is that, is that him projecting his insecurities and his problems onto you? Or is that actually just a problem with you? And the obvious and truthful response would be, it's not a problem with me at all. I mean, what rugby player out there doesn't go out and make mistakes on the rugby field? You know, if to judge someone based on their mistakes playing a game is shallow and foolish. Yeah, it's crazy. So you should, you know, in the perfect world, you would never have had to pick up those thoughts that you picked up about yourself. You were obviously young, so you were going to inevitably without someone intervening. But, well, me being who I was at the time was, in some ways predisposed to pick things up the way I picked them up and deal with them the way I did. But in essence, it was never your fault that you didn't deserve what happened to you. It was never your fault that that's what you dealt with. It's just now your responsibility. That's what you picked up from those moments. But it's just now your responsibility to deal with them and actually process them in a way that means that you acknowledge that they're not true and they have never been true, and that you can actually let them go and pick up something new that is true about you, which is that you're not defined by your performance and your worth is found in other things. And so that was probably the most eye-opening part of my journey, I guess, because prior to that, I described it as like I was trying to cut the heads off weeds and hope that the weed would die. As we know, if anyone's ever been in the garden with the parents or whatever, if you cut, you know, the leaves off or the flower off or whatever, it doesn't really do much. The weeds seem to come back pretty strong. The only way to get rid of them is to pull them out and from the roots. And I guess I was initially, in some ways, thinking that perhaps if I just immersed myself in sport all the time, and that would take my mind off it, then this would completely disappear. And although that helped, because it helped me cope with those moments and gave me relief, it actually provided me with a window of opportunity for me to actually then explore in a more, because I was in a better state of mind, and I guess in a more, what would be the word, cognitive and healthy way, why these problems were there in the first place. And until I realized that there was actually that process to be done, I wasn't doing that. I was just sort of coping and hoping that was going to be the answer on the long way out. But yeah, this changed that whole perspective. I now felt like I could see the roots of all of what was going on, and could slowly but surely along my journey now walk through those moments in my life in the past that I hadn't dealt with, and start to pull the roots out from, well, start, like I said, start to pull the whole weed out from the roots once and for all. And my, I guess the testament to my story would be that I can now see how that has changed my experience in ways that have not required constant effort. It's just been something that at the end of the day, although there are still things I'm dealing with, at the end of the day, it's meant that some things have started to just slowly fall off my experience as I've started to deal with those traumatic experiences in the past.
It's extraordinary. There's one particular story that we spoke about on the phone the other week.
Sure.
where you'd fit, was it at Tigers or Worcester where you're walking? I think it was at Welford Road, right? Where you're walking around and a woman picks you out and you go over to sign an autograph, but she says something which was pretty
humbling, right? Yeah. So I had, I think I played 80 minutes that game and we're doing a lap of honour at the end. And generally speaking, you know, at Welford Road, we clap the crowd or whatever.
Yeah.
And you'd see, obviously, a lot of people want you to come over and speak to them, especially on the terrace side where the people stand right up against basically the barrier and the sideline. And so we got around it. I usually like to sort of interact with fans as best I could. And I saw someone like specifically calling me over and I thought I'll go and speak to them, assuming that it was going to be along the lines of, you know, good game to the team or whatever, or I can't remember how I played. I might have assumed it was going to be a good game for me, or I might have assumed she's going to say, what was that?
But that's a good thing anyway, in terms of your recovery, right?
Yeah, exactly. But I sort of just went over and, you know, said, you know, thanks for coming and supporting us. And she said, look, I'll well done or whatever. I'd really like to just say something to you though, if that's okay. I said, yeah, sure, fire away. Expect, you know, half expecting her just to ask for an autograph or something. And she said, you obviously just released the stuff on the RPA, the Lift the Weight campaign. I sort of shared a bit of my story that I've shared today. And she said, my son was watching that recently, and up until then he had basically wanted to take his own life and had been really struggling with, you know, trying to do that or about to do that or whatever. And he watched this and now it feels like there's a fresh amount of hope that he can actually overcome what he's facing, and he doesn't want to give up anymore. And I was just taken back because, man, I was knackered. I, again, expecting it to be about rugby and only rugby. And it's funny how in moments like that, you know, rugby seems like the be all and end all. And then immediately my mind was just sobered to a far greater reality of, like, we're talking about people's lives here.
It's extraordinary.
And, yeah. And her saying that, and I was just like, you know, if my whole career was purely embraced, you know, summed up in that moment, I'd be satisfied because, you know, no matter how well you play and how long your career is and everything like that, you can get to 60 and I guess be forgotten regardless. But for in some way, rugby to give me a slight bit of platform for, you know, I'm not the most famous, I'm not even close. And in fact, I wouldn't even say famous at all, but for it to give me a slight little bit of platform to be able to share my story on an RPA forum and for it to have that effect on someone, again, sharing about my struggles, I just felt so incredibly humbled that that I could be a part of that story in some way, and just so happy that someone's life had actually been turned around in some way. And so, yeah, that was, again, more just solidifying within inside of myself that this journey was something that could actually bring a lot of good, regardless of how much it caused me pain to begin with. And that it was continually worth actually sharing my story, which, again, why I find myself here, why I'm so stoked that you're doing what you're doing, because obviously, I guess you understand the exact same thing, that actually, although it has some stigma, although it's obviously losing that as more and more stuff like this happens, although it has some stigma attached to it, so it might have some consequence. Somebody out there might think, shame on him for talking about his emotions like that. I really couldn't get less because of this stories that far outweigh that of how people's lives have been changed. And I'm just so lucky and blessed to be a part of that.
Mate, makes me so happy that she did that. Cause I mean, she acknowledges the impact you've had on her son, but I mean, the impact that those sentences she said would have had on you will genuinely be life-changing and put everything in perspective. And it's just it's amazing thing to do. Well, both sides of the coin, really.
I'm grateful she did. It's sort of a sense of encouragement, especially.
Yeah, absolutely. John, thank you so much for coming on.
Mate, all good.
Unbelievable hour 20 minutes. yeah, second longest podcast we've done actually. So far. Yeah, the other one was topping hour and a half with John Barr, but yeah, I mean, I what an amazing story. So like, mate,
stoked to share it.
Yeah. And where can people find you if you're not actually that active on social media? Are you trying to find you? You're a ghost.
It's on purpose, I think. That's a whole, we could get into a whole other topic if we did that, but no, there's a reason for that. But yeah, I'm on Facebook, so there's ways around messaging that I might be able to see it, in terms of even if you're not a friend, you can still message me and hold nice. I'd see them every odd occasion,
But quick disclaimer, he's not a counsellor.
I am not a counsellor. Yeah, exactly. Well, my story is my story, and it's not the same for anyone else, I guess. But I guess if there's some hope that can be gathered from my story, but also perhaps some encouragement to explore similar things that I might have explored that helped me, then go for it. But
yeah,
I saw professionals. It helped me. You should do the same if you're in a similar place. There's no shame in it. But I can definitely not stand in the place of that professional.
No.
And you wouldn't want that anyway. I promise you. So, yeah.
John, mate, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, mate.
Take care of yourself.
Thanks for listening to that episode of The Rut. Please give us a subscribe if you haven't already, and find us on Twitter and Instagram through @TheRutPod. For more updates on who's coming on the show next. Special thanks to my team, Ricky Batchu and Phil Bateman, for helping me produce this podcast. Next time on The Rut, I sit down with international best-selling author, speaker, and a world leader on the science of positive thinking and goal achievement, Brian May. See you then.